Okay, so let's open with a word of prayer. Lord, thank you for this time in your word. And as we study the concluding chapters of Genesis, we want to thank you for all that you've taught us. And I pray that you will help us to incorporate that into our lives. The examples and the things that happened, all the events that happened, all have lessons for us. And so I pray to you that you will help us to receive them in a positive way. Now bless our studies today. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay, so in your notebook, it's page 178, if you penned it in. But at the top it says, the sons of Joseph, verse 7. And that's verse 7 in chapter, well, it begins, let's see. We're actually at the bottom, the blessing of Ephraim and Manasseh, okay, which is verses 8 through 22. Right, something's right here. Give me 1 second. I just got to check something in my notes. Make sure I'm doing the right thing here. Yeah, chapter 48. No wonder I'm on the wrong page here. 46, 47, 48. Okay. So after having blessed the sons of Joseph, and he took them as his own sons in effect, the next thing we see at the bottom of the page is where he blesses Ephraim and Manasseh, the sons of Joseph. And that goes from verse 8 through 22. So, turning in your Bible to chapter 48, verse 8, we'll begin. When Israel saw Joseph's sons, he said, "Who are these?" Joseph said to his father, "These are my sons whom God has given me here." So he said, "Bring them to me, please, that I may bless them." Now the eyes of Israel were so dim from age that he could not see. Then Joseph brought them close to him, and he kissed them and embraced them. Israel said to Joseph, "I never expected to see your face, and behold, God has let me see your children as well." God is certainly a gracious God. Then Joseph took them from his knees and bowed with his face to the ground. Joseph took them both, Ephraim with his right hand towards Israel's left, and Manasseh with his left hand towards Israel's right, and brought them close to him. He was positioning them so that the blessing would go to whom he wanted it. You know, right, whether you're on the right or the left affects which blessing you get. Yeah, but you position them. Whatever your reason is, that's what you do. You position them. He couldn't see anymore.
I'm just saying, he wasn't choosing Manasseh because he wanted to be sure Manasseh got the blessing. It was just...
Well, yeah, but all I'm saying is he positioned him. Okay.
Yes.
He blessed Joseph and said, no, wait, but Israel stretched out his right hand and laid it on the head of Ephraim, who was the younger, and his left hand on Manasseh's head, crossing his hands, although Manasseh was the firstborn. So this is another instance in the book of Genesis of the firstborn actually receiving the benefit, let's put it this way, of a child who was not born first receiving the rights of the firstborn. He blessed Joseph and said, "The God before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac walked, the God who has been my shepherd all my life to this day, the angel who has redeemed me from evil, bless the lads and may my name live on in them, and the names of my fathers Abraham and Isaac, and may they grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth." When Joseph saw that his father laid his right hand on Ephraim's head, it displeased him, because the right hand should go on the older. So he's reversing it, like we've seen a lot of times in the Bible, this reversal. And he grasped his father's hand to remove it from Ephraim's head to Manasseh's head. Joseph said to his father, "Not so, my father, for this one is the firstborn. Place your right hand on his head." But his father refused and said, "I know, my son, I know. He also will become a people, and he also will be great. However, his younger brother shall be greater than he, and his descendants shall become a multitude of people." He blessed them, saying, "By you, Israel, will pronounce blessings, saying, may God make you like Ephraim and Manasseh." Then he put Ephraim before Manasseh. Thus he put Ephraim before Manasseh. Then Israel said to Joseph, "Behold, I am about to die, but God will be with you and bring you back to the land of your fathers." One thing that Jacob never forgot was the covenant. That was always foremost in his mind. "I give you one portion more than your brothers, which I took from the hand of the Amorite with my sword and my bow." So he's giving an extra portion to Joseph. Okay, let's go to the notes now. The blessing of Ephraim and Manasseh. You know, Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young put out an album once, and the title of the album was Manasseh. And I've always wondered if they got that from the Bible. The blessing of Ephraim and Manasseh is recounted in great detail. In the account of Jacob blessing his sons, that's chapter 49, these two are not mentioned. The overall function of the present account, then, is to augment the blessings of chapter 49 with an accounting of the two sons who have taken their place in the house of Jacob along with the other sons. Okay. Great care is taken to emphasize in the blessings of these two sons. Ephraim, the younger brother, was given the blessing of the firstborn over Manasseh. As has been the case throughout the patriarchal narratives, it was the younger son who was chosen to carry the line of blessing. And we saw that with Jacob and Esau and so forth. Before Jacob went on to address the sons specifically, Joseph interrupted him, attempting... That doesn't read right. Let me read it the way it should read. Before Jacob went on to address the sons specifically, Joseph interrupted him, attempting to have Jacob, put to have Jacob place his right hand on Manasseh rather than Ephraim, thus giving the blessing of Manasseh to the eldest son. That's the way Joseph saw it should be. After objecting to Joseph's attempt, Jacob went on to bless the two sons specifically. He blessed them, thus giving Ephraim prominence over Manasseh. Jacob's blessing is a storehouse of key thematic terms that direct the reader's attention to several major themes at work in the book as a whole. First, God is the God before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac walked. That's a very important statement. You might read that and gloss over it, but what he's doing in there is saying, I worship the living God just as my fathers did. To say that I worship the same God as Abraham and Isaac is essentially to say, I worship the true and living God because that's who they worship. So he's identifying himself with his father's and grandfather's faith in the God of Israel. Throw this away. Text message. Okay. Hopefully this won't happen again. Okay. Okay. As has been the case throughout the patriarchal narratives, I'll pick it up where we were, it was the younger son who was chosen to carry on the line of blessing. Now, who chose him? God. This was God's making a choice. Before Jacob went on to address the son specifically, Joseph interrupted him, attempting to have Jacob place his right hand on Manasseh rather than Ephraim, thus giving the blessing of Manasseh, the older son. After objecting to Joseph's attempt, Jacob went on to bless the two sons specifically. He blessed them, giving Ephraim prominence over Manasseh. And we've seen that all the way through the scripture, the younger shall serve the elder. Jacob's blessing is a storehouse of key thematic terms that direct the reader's attention to several major themes at work in the whole book. Okay, that's where we were. So, God is the God before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac walked. We discussed that. Not only does the mention of Abraham and Isaac connect Jacob's faith in God to his immediate forefathers, but it also helps tie together the faith of the earliest patriarchs with that of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. At two earlier points in the book, the faith of the primeval patriarchs described as those who walked with God. The faith of the early fathers was at one with the patriarchs. They walked with God. So that's what's happening there. And we know that Jacob led a rugged life. And he certainly wasn't the man of highest integrity. But he did love God. And he did want God's blessing for his sons. At the same time, this description of God also serves to link the faith of the fathers with that of the later generations of God's covenant people. And so, in a sense, since I'm Jewish, I can say I worship the God of my forefathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And that's what God wants from his people. And since we know that the middle wall of partition has been broken down, he wants Gentiles to do the same thing. Now, the Gentiles can't say, I worship the same God as my forefathers, because then they would be Jewish. But what they can say is, I worship the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, just like the Jewish people do. I can't hear you. Start over. What we've actually been grafted into is the Abrahamic covenant. That's the grafting in. So what you and I are saying are just looking at the same thing from two angles. Okay, at the same time, this description of God also serves to link the faith of the fathers with that of the later generations of God's covenant people. Okay, now this next paragraph here, I don't know what happened, but go down to the second line over to the right where it says, as Moses. There's a typo there, and that's where we should actually begin. As Moses said in Deuteronomy 30:16, the essence of the covenant relationship was that God's people were to love God and walk in his ways. And as the prophets were later to say, this is one of my favorite verses in Micah 6:8. What does the Lord require of you? To act justly and love mercy and to walk humbly with your God. That's really a beautiful way of putting it. Because if we do that, we can be assured that we will have a close work with God. Jacob's short statement of faith then provides a theological link connecting and identifying the faith throughout the ages. God is also described in Jacob's blessing as the God who has shepherded me all my life to this day. Jacob recognized Remember we did that thing with Jacob, up and down and up and down? Jacob recognized the purpose of God in all of this. Okay, so God is also described in Jacob's blessing as the God who has shepherded me all the days of this, all my life to this day, and as the angel who has delivered me from all harm. It is unusual that God is described as the angel, since earlier in the book it says, God sent his angel, or simply that one of the patriarchs was visited by the angel of the Lord. The fact of the matter is, there are times in the days of the fathers when angels made themselves present to men. And there are also times in the scriptures where the angel of God himself made himself visible and manifested himself to men. And the angel of God is the second person of the Trinity. Okay, moving along. The blessing of the two sons picks up the blessing of the promise to Abraham. They are to be called by Jacob's name and the name of Abraham and Isaac. Just as God had promised to Abraham, I will make you your name, it should be your, I should make your name great. They were to increase greatly, just as God had promised Abraham, I will make you into a great nation. And when you think about it, how many people originally of Jacob's family went to Egypt? 70. How many people left Egypt during the Exodus? Millions. They grew like rabbits. The last two verses are difficult to understand, not only in the immediate context, but also in the entire picture of Jacob that emerges in the Genesis narrative. Throughout these narratives, Jacob has been pictured not as a man of the sword and bow. Remember it says he was a gentleman and a keeper of flocks? But as a quiet man staying among the tents. Elsewhere, Jacob is said of the inhabitants of the land of Canaan, if they join forces to attack me, I and my household will be destroyed. Now, suddenly on his deathbed, Jacob revealed another picture of himself as he bequeathed to Joseph the portion of land he had taken by force. He's recognizing now that this land, although he took it by force, Joseph and his descendants and all descendants of Jacob will not take it by their own force, but God will see to it that they own it by his force. Though he spoke to Joseph, his use of the plural pronouns, see in verse 21, for example, where it says, I got to turn back to it. In verse 21, then Israel said to Joseph, behold, I'm about to die, but God will be with you and bring you back to the land of your fathers. Now, B, though he spoke to Joseph, his use of the plural pronouns in the Hebrew, these are the word you, and we can do that in English too. The word you can be used singularly or as a group, shows that he was addressing a larger audience. In light of the fact that he spoke of a time when they would return to the land of their fathers, that larger audience was to be represented in the tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh. He's really greatly blessing Manasseh and Manasseh, and the reason he's doing that is because Joseph was his favorite, and Joseph was his redeemer. Well, God was his redeemer, but God used Joseph to be his redeemer. Okay, now, did everybody get a copy of chapter 49? Because that's where we are now. So who needs a copy of chapter 49? Raise your feminine hand. I hope nobody takes me seriously in this class. Did anybody else? Okay. Here you go. Guess I could use one too. Okay, chapter 49. And we'll begin with the introduction to the chapter in verses 1 and 2. Then Jacob summoned his sons and said, "Assemble yourselves that I may tell you what will befall you in the days to come. Gather together and hear, O sons of Jacob, and listen to your father." Okay, so going back to the notes, the poetic discourse of chapter 49 plays a key role in the strategy of the patriarchal narratives as well as the strategy of the book. Jacob's last words to his son have become a final statement of the book's major theme, God's plan to restore the lost blessing through the offspring of Abraham. The blessing that was lost in Eden. The blessing promised to Abraham was it's thousands of years ago. Actually, really, the blessing that God meant for mankind was lost at the fall. And that's most poignantly illustrated in their expulsion from the Garden of Eden. And God's plan of redemption, of course, is saving souls. But more than that, it's returning us to the blessing that God intended for us in the first place. And he does that. He's doing that through the Jewish people, because it's the Jewish people through whom we got the scriptures and through whom we got the Messiah. I was once having a debate with a girl who I thought was going to stab me. She was so angry. And she didn't believe anything. I forget what religion she was. But whatever religion she was, I said to her, she said that she was against Jewish people and she claimed to believe the Bible. That was the main thing. I said, if you believe the Bible and you're against Jewish people, what about the fact that Jesus was Jewish? And she said, no, he wasn't. And I had to open the Bible and show her, and she's still, where'd you get that? What translation is that? Okay, the poetic discourse of chapter 49 plays a key role in the strategy of the patriarchal narratives as well as the strategy of the book as a whole. Jacob's last words to his son have become a final statement of the book's major theme, God's plan to restore the lost blessing through the offspring of Abraham. And that goes right back to the Abrahamic covenant. The key to Moses' understanding of Jacob's last words lies in the narrative framework that surrounds them. In verse 1, we are explicitly told that Jacob was speaking of those things that would happen in the last days. And in the NIV, they translate it in days to come. So they take a different perspective on it. The same expression occurs in the Pentateuch. Everybody know what the Pentateuch is? Excuse me? First five books of the Pentateuch. You get a star on your page. Okay. The same expression occurs in the Pentateuch as an introduction to two other poetic discourses, the Oracle of Balaam and the Last Words of Moses. On all three occasions, the subject matter is introduced by the phrase, in the last days. is that of God's future of his chosen people. At the center of that deliverance stands a king. In Genesis 49, that king is connected with the house of Judah. And we'll see that when we get to Genesis 49, where he tells each of his sons what will happen to them in the future. It's there that he declares that the king that they're waiting, the final king, will come through the line of Judah. Okay, Joseph blesses his sons, verses 3 through 27. Now, I think the best way to do it is do one son at a time. You know what I mean? So first we're going to do Reuben. We're going to go back and forth from the Bible to the thing. Because if I read all of this, when I go to the notes to read, it won't be as understandable. Reuben. Well, let me start. Okay, Reuben, you are my firstborn, my might and the beginning of my strength, preeminent in dignity and preeminent in power. Uncontrolled as water, you shall not have preeminence. Because you went up to your father's bed, then you defiled it, he went up to my couch. Remember what Reuben did when he made love to, had sex with Jacob's, one of Jacob's wives? And Jacob didn't forget about that. Be sure your sin will find you out. By the way, one of the reasons it's a little difficult to interpret this section is because it's a poem. This section we're in right now, where he tells each of the sons, it's a poem. And so you've got to look at it as poetry. And as we know, poetry generally has a lot of symbolic language in it. Okay, so go down to Joseph blesses his sons. The sons of Leah, Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Zebulun, and Issachar, lead the list, followed by the sons of the handmaidens. Bilhah gives birth to Dan. Zilpah gives birth to Gad and Asher. And again, Bilhah gives birth to Naphtali. Then finally, the sons of Rachel come, Joseph and Benjamin. So that's who he's going to be addressing here. So we start with Reuben. The key to regarding the saying of Reuben is the saying, you will no longer excel. The word excel is a play on the two statements that are preceding it, excelling in honor and excelling in power. Though Reuben has excelled, he will no longer excel. And I've said a number of times in class, there's no such thing as getting away with it. That concept doesn't exist in the kingdom of God. Now, it is true that we may get away with it in this life. And David has a psalm where he, remember, you know that psalm, I can't remember what name it is, where he pours out his complaint, where he says, the rich, they have no pains in their death, and they prosper. And he says, then I entered the tabernacle of God, and I understood their end. And, for example, somebody once witnessed to Bill Gates, and he said, I have no time for that. I hope the man gets saved. But if he doesn't, when he gets to heaven, he'll say to himself, I would have given away all the billions I had just to have salvation. He'll realize. Okay, continuing on. The reason given is brief but to the point. For you went up onto my couch and defiled it. This refers to an episode briefly noted in 35:22. While Israel was living in that region, Reuben went in and slept with his concubine Bilhah, and Israel heard of it. As with the rest of these sayings, the message was terse and to the point. Reuben no longer had the right of the firstborn of Jacob because he violated the honor of his father. And it would do well, especially for men, to remember that if you commit sexual immorality, that whatever, 10, 15, 20, doesn't matter, 30 minutes of pleasure is not worth the anguish and grief that will follow it. And it sooner or later it happens. And although Judah was the strongest of his brother, the rights of the firstborn belonged to Joseph. And that's affirmed in 1 Chronicles 5:1 and 2. Ultimately, the purpose behind these initial sayings was the elimination of the rightful heirs to make room for Judah and Joseph at the top. Many years later, the author of the Book of Chronicles offered the following explanation. Reuben was the firstborn, but when he defiled his marriage bed, his rights as the firstborn were given to Joseph, son of Israel. So he could not be listed in the genealogy was given to the sons of Joseph, son of Israel. And although Judah was the strongest and a ruler came from him, that doesn't read right. Let me show you how it should read. I wish I could touch type, but I can't. That's why I make these mistakes. Although Reuben was the strongest, nope, it is Judah. Although Judah was the strongest and the ruler would come from him, the rights of the firstborn went to Joseph. In his reference to the sons of Joseph taking the birthright, the chronicler was no doubt thinking of Genesis 48:5, where Jacob said, Ephraim and Manasseh, the two sons of Joseph, will be mine, just as Reuben and Simeon are mine. Okay, now we move on to Simeon and Levi. Let's see how we're doing here. And now we're up to Simeon and Levi. So let's go to our scriptures, starting from verse 5. Simeon and Levi are brothers. Their swords are implements of violence. Let my soul not enter into their council. Let not my glory be united with their assembly. Because in their anger they slew men, and in their self-will they lamed oxen. Remember when they did that to a whole town? Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. I will disperse them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. Okay, let's read Simeon and Levi. Simeon and Levi are grouped together because they were the instigators of the bloodshed against the city of Shechem. At that time, Jacob protested vehemently against the two sons and their attack against the defenseless city. You know what the real mistake was that they made? They didn't counsel with their father before they did that. I know when I was a boy, if I wanted to do something, if I go ride my bike, I didn't have to ask my dad. But if I wanted to take the bus in town to go to the movies when I was 12 or so, I had to check with my dad. Tell him where I was going. Usually it was with my friend Larry and so forth and so on. They should have really talked to their father about this before they did anything. And look what the end result is. Look what's happening to them. Okay. Here Jacob gave his final verdict on their actions. The two tribes of Levi and Simeon would not have their own portion in the inheritance of the land. That's a high price to pay, but think about what they did. They committed mass murder. The fulfillment of Jacob's words can be found in that the tribe of Simeon virtually disappears from the biblical narratives after the time of the conquest, and in the fact that the tribe of Levi was given the priesthood and hence was not given its own inheritance in the apportioning of the land. When they divided up the land, the tribe of Levi didn't get land. And they were taken care of course. You have to, you know, God did see to it they were taken care of, but they didn't get their own parcel of land. Okay, Judah. Judah, your brothers shall praise you, your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies, your father's sons shall bow down to you. Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, you have gone up. He couches, he lies down as a lion, and as a lion who dares to rouse him. And this is the key here. This is a very important verse. The scepter. Now, everybody knows the scepter. Only one person in the kingdom had a scepter, and that was the king, and that was one of the symbols of his kingship. And he says here, the scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet until Shiloh comes. Now, that's a little confusing because of that word Shiloh. It's a Hebrew word that they transliterated. And the way this should really read, if you translate it correctly, is the scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler from between his feet until he comes to whom it belongs. That would be a better rendering. Okay? He ties his foal to the vine and his donkey's colt to the choice vine. He washes his garments in wine and his robes in the blood of grapes. His eyes are dull from wine and his teeth white from milk. Okay, you can see how this is poetry. It's really a long poem. Having eliminated the older brothers as rightful heirs of the blessing, Jacob foretold a future of the tribe of Judah that pictured him as the preeminent son. We have seen that the author of the Book of Chronicles, that Joseph's words did not give Judah the right of firstborn, which according to Genesis 48:5 belonged to Joseph. Though he did not have the right of the firstborn, Judah had been chosen over all the others as the royal tribe. According to the Book of Chronicles, Judah prevailed, and that can be translated, was the strongest over his brothers, and thus became heir to the throne. As the writer of Psalm 78 later puts it, the Lord rejected the tents of Joseph. He did not choose the tribe of Ephraim, but he chose the tribe of Judah, Mount Zion, which he loved. As is suggested in these later biblical texts, the words of Jacob regarding Judah in Genesis 49 anticipated in many details the future rise, it should be, of David to Israel's throne. And in the promise that God made to David, a lot of people say, well, there's none of David's throne descendants sitting on a throne right now. The Bible's wrong. That's not what God said. What he basically was saying was he is going to keep the line of Judah, the royal line, intact, which he has done. And one day, there will be someone from that tribe who will be the final king of the royal line. Okay? Bear in mind something that's very interesting. When the temple was destroyed, all the genealogical records were destroyed with it. So people couldn't go anymore and see who their ancestors were. And now, by today, if you're talking to a Jewish person, there's no way he or she can know what tribe they're from. It's impossible. You can't do it by last names. There's people who do that. You really can't. Names got changed after the Second World War. Just can't do it. But we do still know that the tribes are intact because we know that 12,000 from each of the tribes of Israel is going to make an appearance in the Book of Revelation. So God, in some mysterious way that we don't fully understand, is keeping the 12 tribes intact. And that includes Judah, which contains the royal line. Unlike the imagery used of the other sons, the words regarding Judah are quite transparent, though they are, of course, made up of poetic images. Judah is described as a victorious warrior who returns home from battle and greeted by the shouts of praise from his brothers. The parallelism of verse 8 is extended by the statement, "Your father's sons will bow down to you." See, it says, "Judah, your brothers shall praise you." And then the parallelism there is, "Your father's sons shall bow down to you." That's a form of Hebrew poetry where meanings rhyme, not sounds. Where was I now? It is difficult not to see in this an intentional allusion to the dream of Joseph in which his father's sons would come down before him. In other words, what was to happen to Joseph and did in fact happen in the course of the narrative has been picked up by way of this image and transferred to the future house of Judah. What has happened to Joseph is portrayed as a picture of what would happen to Judah in the last days. So in a sense, Joseph was a foreshadow of the royal line of Judah. The point of Jacob's words is that Judah will hold such a status among the tribes of Israel until that one should be one, until one comes to whom it belongs. That's the correct translation. Does somebody have a question? Oh, thank you. I'm sorry. Let's go back. Somebody suggested to me I take like a business card, and I got to start doing that. So number two, the picture of the victorious is extended with the picture of Judah as a young lion sleeping in its den after having devoured its prey. The end of verse 9 speaks for itself. Who dares rouse him? I would strongly suggest that if you ever see a lion sleeping, don't wake him up. That's after 4.5 years of seminary. Okay. The end of verse 9 speaks for itself. Who dares rouse him? In verse 10, the picture is filled out with a picture of the young warrior as king. He is the one who holds the scepter and the royal staff. The point of Jacob's words is that Judah will hold such a status among the tribes of Israel until one comes. I don't know, I'm missing these E's here. One comes to whom it belongs. Those who reign among the house of Judah will do so in anticipation of the one to whom the kingship truly belongs. The word Shiloh, found in some English expressions, is simply an untranslated form of the Hebrew expression meaning one to whom it belongs. So they didn't bother to translate that. It is not a name as such, nor it is to be associated with the site of the tabernacle in the days of Samuel. It's just it's a transliteration. They took what the Hebrew word sounded like and they put it in English letters. But its translation is to whom it belongs.
Why exactly did they do that?
I mean, I don't know. They should. There's a lot of times where they transliterate and I say, why did they do that? For example, the word Christ is a transliteration. The word Mashiach is a Hebrew word that means the anointed one. In Greek, Christos is the anointed one, and from that we got Christ. But that's not his name. What they should have done was Jesus the anointed one if they were going to do a correct translation. As a matter of fact, if they wanted to really translate it completely, Jesus comes from the Hebrew word Yeshua. And Yeshua means salvation. So his word is the salvation of the anointed one. So sometimes they transliterate, and I say to myself, why? It's not that they're lazy, you know, they could do it, and I wonder why sometimes they don't. The most startling aspect...
In terms of the New Testament, certain words were transliterated because the instructions to the interpreters from King John or King James was they were not to translate anything such that would interfere.
I would tend to agree with what you're saying because... the reason I agree with what you're saying, although I've never heard it put that way before, you know the book of James, that's not his name. His name was Jacob. But King James wanted his name in the Bible, so he officially changed it from Jacob to James.
Seriously?
Yeah. The true name of James was it's the letter of Jacob.
And the brother
Wow. He was the king. What were you going to do?
But he's God. Okay, I feel like you opened a huge can of worms.
No, he's not God. No,
yeah.
Because James,
Pandora's box.
Because James starts out as like identifying who this James is and differentiating like from the James of the apostle.
Yeah, but there was more than one James.
Right.
Yeah, and his name in any event should be Jacob. Any Jewish man who's called James... The Hebrew name really is Jacob. The most startling aspect of the picture of this one from the tribe of Judah comes next, and the obedience of the nations is his. The use of the plural word nations rather than the singular nation suggests that Jacob had in view a kingship that extended beyond the boundaries of Israel to include other nations as well. There may be an anticipation of this view of the promise of God to Jacob in 28:3 and 48:1, I will make you a community of people. So this king who is going to come from the line of Judah, the kings of Judah were kings of Judah. But this king is not going to, his authority is not going to be limited to Judah. It's going to be worldwide. 5. In any case, later biblical writers were apparently guided by texts such as this one in formulating their view of the future reign of the future David. Verses 11 and 12 draw an extended picture of the reign of this one from the tribe of Judah. In his day, and this is the Messiah, there will again be plenty for everyone. Poetically, this idea expressed of plenitude is short text in their reign of the coming Messiah expressed with the image. What did I do here? Let me try this again. Boy, do I wish I could touch type. Okay, let me try. Poetically, this idea is of expressed plentitude is a short text in the reign of the coming Messiah, expressed with the image of the donkey tethered with the choicest vine and clothing, washed in vintage wine. That's how that should read.
The image is plural.
Excuse me?
We keep the image is plural, cross out the image singular. It's got two examples, the donkey tethered and the clothing washed.
Good. Okay, Jacob's remaining sons. No, I didn't read something. The sense of imagery is that wine, the symbol of prosperity and blessing, will be soon plentiful, and even the choicest vines will be put to everyday use as tethering animals of burden, and vintage wine will be as commonplace as wash water. Verse 12 returns to the picture of the king of Judah. His eyes are darker than the wine, and his teeth are whiter than milk. He is a picture of strength and power. Later biblical writers drew heavily from the imagery in this text in their portrayal of the reign of the coming Messiah. See how we're doing here. Good, good. Jacob's remaining sons. Jacob's words regarding his remaining sons, with the exception of Joseph, are noticeable, not only for their brevity, but also for their cryptic allusions to coming events that at that time lie in the future of the particular tribe. True to the poetic quality of the text, the images on the destiny of the remaining sons are, in most cases, based on a wordplay of the son's name. The central theme of each image is that of prosperity. Just as the image of the victorious king from the tribe of Judah, who will reign over all nations in a time of rich blessing, so each of the remaining brothers will experience the same prosperity and blessing through their descendants. Okay, Zebulun. Let's see if we can find Zebulun in here. This is short. Zebulun will dwell at the seashore, and he shall be a haven for ships, and his flank shall be toward Sidon. Zebulun, whose boundaries in 19:10 to 16 do not touch the sea. What's wrong here? It should be just 13. I don't know where I got that. You see where it says Zebulun, whose boundaries in 19. Oh, it's back in 19, right. Do not touch the sea, will extend its borders as far as Sidon. The Hebrew word Zebulun, which means lofty abode, has become a cipher for the promised land into the far recesses of Sidon. There is apparently an intended wordplay between abode and abide. In other words, this land will be their abode, and they will abide there. That is where they will live. Okay, Issachar. Issachar is a strong donkey lying down between the sheepfolds. When he saw that a resting place was good and that the land was pleasant, he bowed his shoulders to bear burdens and became a slave at forced labor. Issachar, whose name is a play on the word wages, is pictured as a strong donkey who sees that his land is of rest is good and applies his back to the burden. The expression, he sees how good is his resting place, is perhaps an allusion to chapter 1, where the similar expression, and God saw that it was good, is a constant reminder that God's purpose in creation was to provide the good for man. And that's what redemption is all about, to bring us back to that place of blessing. The use of the term resting place or land of rest aligns the words of Jacob with the theme of the future rest that God will give his people in the promised land. There's coming a day when Jewish people will live in the land of Israel, and today they're not dwelling safely by any means. There's coming a day when they will, because all of the swords will have been beaten in the plowshares. Okay, Dan. Dan shall judge his people as one of the tribes of Israel. Dan shall be a serpent in the way, a horned snake in the path, that bites the horse's heel so that his rider falls backwards. For your salvation I wait, O Lord. Okay, let's take Dan. Dan, whose name is a play on the expression he will judge, is the one who will judge his people. He is likened to a snake along a path that attacks the heels of the horse and cunningly defeats the horseman. Though the sense of the image itself is unclear, Jacob's final words regarding Dan show that the image was meant in a positive way. I look for your deliverance, O Lord. Breaking up as it does on the terse, on the increasingly terse poetic images, this expression of hope in the Lord's deliverance provides the much needed clue to the meaning of Jacob's words. In the individual and future destiny of the sons is embodied the hope of Israel. At the center of that hope is the King of Israel. Remember when Pilate said, "You're a king," and he said, "It is as you say." But then he said, "My kingdom is not of this world." If he had said, "Yes, I'm a king and I'm going to rebel against Rome," he'd have been put to death right away. But he said, "I'm a king, but I'm not king of in this world." And Pilate said, "There's no reason to put him to death. He's not rebelling." Okay, next, Gad. "As for Gad, raiders shall raid him, but he will raid at their heels." The brief statement regarding Gad contains a word play on nearly every word. Gad will be attacked by a band of raiders, Yegudanah, and you see Gad and Gud, but he will attack Yagud, them at their heels. So it's kind of like a poetic wordplay there. Again, although it is very brief, the saying falls in line with the others following in the line of prophecy of the line of Judah, in that it gives expression to the hope of the final defeat of the enemy. Asher. "As for Asher, his food shall be rich, and he will yield royal dainties." Asher. The words regarding, I have Naphtali, it should be Asher. That's what confuses me. But wait a second, where's Naphtali? Did I mess something up here? Yeah, I'm going to have to make a correction, because next should actually come. What is this? Okay. So after Dan comes Gad, we read Gad, and after Gad comes Asher. Let me just read Asher again. "The words regarding Naphtali are also brief. The picture they present, which is similar to the others, is a time of great future prosperity and abundance." Now, Naphtali, for some reason, I don't know why, is skipped over in my notes. So I'm going to have to either give you a handout or just redo these couple of pages so that you have it. Excuse me? I can't. I need my sources. "Joseph is a fruitful bough, a fruitful bough by a spring. Its branches run over a wall. The archers bitterly attacked him and shot at him and harassed him, but his bow remained firm and his arms were agile. From the hands of the mighty one of Jacob, from there is the shepherd, the stone of Israel. From the God of your father who helps you, and by the Almighty who blesses you with blessings of heaven above, blessings of the deep that lie beneath, blessings of the beasts of the womb, the blessings of your father have surpassed the blessings of my ancestors. Up to the utmost bound of the everlasting hills may they be on the head of Joseph, and on the crown of the head of the one distinguished among his brothers." Okay, Joseph. As might be expected from the importance of Joseph in the earlier chapters, Jacob has much to say about the future of his tribe. In substance, Jacob's statement regarding Joseph repeat much of what was said about the other brothers after Judah. The difference in the words to Joseph, however, is the repetition of the word blessing. Whereas Jacob's words regarding the other brothers contain a picture of the well-being of the sons and thus figuratively speak of a future blessing, Jacob's words to Joseph explicitly refer to this well-being as a blessing. As such, the words to Joseph fall in line with all those earlier passages in the book that speak specifically of the promised blessing and prepare the way for Moses' final remark about Jacob's words in verse 28. He blessed them each according to his blessing. He blessed them. The reference to the shepherd appears to be an allusion to Jacob's earlier blessing of Ephraim and Manasseh. Could you do me a favor when you get a chance? Just send me an email, and in the email, you just got to put Naphtali, because I want to get this included in here, and in case I forget. And when I see the word Naphtali, or write about Naphtali or something like that. Okay. Benjamin Franklin. No, this was not Ben Franklin. Where am I? Benjamin is a ravenous wolf. In the morning, he devours the prey, and in the evening, he divides the spoil. The picture of Benjamin is similar to that of Judah. Both depict the patriarch's future in terms expressing a victorious conquest over the enemy. In both, the conqueror is a vicious predator, the lion and the wolf. The stark simplicity of these words to Benjamin, however, bring out the sense of the sudden victory and conquest in much stronger terms than the imagery of Judah. All right, now do me one more email, or you can put them both in the same email. You can put it also all in the same email. Chapter 49, 28 through 33. Somehow when I was using my resources, some of these commentaries, it's hard to read them. And one of the things I sometimes have to do is say, where does one, because they don't pay attention to the beginning and ending of a chapter when they do commentaries. They end it where they think it should end. Okay, but conclusion. Moses sums up in unequivocal terms, the substance of Jacob's words to his sons. They are an expression of the theme of blessing that was to be passed along through the seed of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Within Jacob's words to each of the sons after Judah, the theme of a blessing has been evident in two primary images. First, the first side of the blessing is stretched in the image of the victorious warrior. The defeat of the enemy is the prelude to the messianic peace. And the enemy, we know, is Satan in that case. Second, the positive side of the blessing is stressed in the image of great prosperity. Behind such imagery of peace and prosperity lies the picture of the Garden of Eden, Paradise Lost. The focus of Jacob's words has been the promise that when the one comes to whom the kingship really belongs, there will once again be peace and prosperity that God meant all to have in the Garden of Eden. So put the word meant in there. Okay, so that's the end of this chapter. And what we'll do, this was chapter 49. Take chapter 50 so you have it. Of course, we will do it. Oh, you got it already? Okay.